How? We weren't really listening, his mother says. It was just on. The woman said she wants people to die of AIDS? Miranda, age 11, reports. Neil's father gives her a shushing glance. Neil's mother sighs. We weren't really listening, she repeats. Neil knows he should let it go. This household operates through a series of unspoken truces, negotiated by instinct more than by actual conversation. Neil has always considered his gayness to be an open secret with his parents. They've met Peter. They know what the story is, but the story is never said out loud. Neil can lead his version of his life, and his parents can believe in their version of their good son. But open secret is a lie we like to tell ourselves. It's a lie we often told ourselves, in both sickness and in health. It doesn't work, because if you feel you still have a secret, there is no way to be truly open. In the interest of self-preservation, it is sometimes best to keep something back, to keep something hidden. But there usually comes a moment, and Neil is hitting his now, when you don't want self-preservation to define who you are or who your family is. Truces may stop the battles, but part of you will always feel like you're at war. Neil should let it go, but he doesn't. He thinks of Craig and Harry kissing, even though he can't remember their names. He thinks of Peter, and of how Peter's parents take Neil in, extend their family so that he's like a member. He thinks of his sister listening to the trash talk on the radio, and his parents letting it go unanswered. How can you not hear that? He asks his mother. When something like that is being said, how can you just sit there? Neil never talks to his mother like this. Not since he was little, not since it was forced out of him by punishment after punishment. His father steps in, conciliatory. He is always the good cop. Neil is tired of his parents being cops at all.
We really didn't hear it. If we had, we would have turned it off. We were listening to the news at the top of the hour and left it on.
When someone talks like that, you should hear it, Neil says, his voice rising. His mother looks at him like he's an incompetent employee. Why should we hear it? Because you have a gay son. Miranda's jaw drops theatrically. This is, to her, the most interesting family conversation to ever, ever happen. Neil couldn't have shocked them more if he'd used a dirty word. He's broken the truce.
Neil, his dad begins, his tone half-warning, half-sympathy.
No, if some asshole on the radio was saying that all immigrants should go back to the countries they're from, you'd pay attention. Even if you weren't listening, you'd hear it. If they were saying they hope that all Koreans die of AIDS, your blood would boil higher with every single word. But when it's gays they're talking about, you let it slide. You don't bother to hear it. It's acceptable to you. Even if you don't agree with it, and I'm not saying you want me to get AIDS from kissing Peter, you accept it when someone else says it. You let it happen. We tried to tell them what was happening. We tried to tell them the disease was spreading. We needed doctors. We needed scientists. Most of all, we needed money, and to get money, we needed attention. We put our lives in other people's hands, and for the most part, they looked at us blankly and said, "What lives? What hands?" I am gay. I have always been gay. I will always be gay. You have to understand that, and you have to understand that we are not really a family until you understand that. Neil's father shakes his head.
Of course we're a family. How can you say we're not a family?
What has gotten into you? His mother asks. Your sister is right here. This isn't appropriate conversation for your sister. Appropriate. The word is a well-dressed cage, used to capture the truth and hang it in a room that no one ventures into. She needs to hear this, Neil says. Why shouldn't she hear this? You know I'm gay, don't you, Miranda?
Totally, Miranda answers.
So there are no big revelations here. You all know I'm gay. You all know I have a boyfriend.
But he's never used that word before. It's always been, I'm going over to Peter's house, or I'm going to the movies with Peter. His mother once saw them holding hands as they watched a movie. That's the only reason he's sure they know.
Yes, Neil, Mrs. Kim says, not bothering to hide the irritation in her voice. She picks the paper back up. Now, if we can get back to our Sunday morning. Neil feels he should be pleased by this brief acknowledgement, should take the truce that's being offered once more. The conversation is clearly at its end. His mother has started reading the paper again, and his father is telling him to have some breakfast. We figure this is it. This is all. Most of us found acceptance through small steps such as these. Our families were rarely willing to make leaps, at least not until the end. But it's not enough for Neil. He feels if he accepts the truce now, it will be months, maybe years, before he gets to this point again. I need you to say it, he tells them. I need to hear you say it. Mrs. Kim throws down the paper and hits the table. What, that we're sorry? For not turning off the radio when some idiot said something idiotic? You're acting like a baby. No, Neil tries to keep control of his voice. I don't need you to say you're sorry. I need you to say that I'm gay. Neil's mother grunts and looks at his father. You deal with this.
Neil, he says, is everything okay? Why are you acting this way?
Just say it. Please, just say it.
It's Miranda who speaks up. You're gay, she says with complete seriousness, and I love you. Tears spring to Neil's eyes. Thank you, Miranda, he says. Then he looks to his parents.
Neil, his father says.
Please.
Why is this so important to you? His mother asks. Why are you doing this?
I just want you to say it. That's all.
I don't have to tell you that you have black hair, do I? I don't have to tell you that you're a boy. Why should I have to tell you this? We know, Neil. Is that what you want to hear? We know.
But you don't mind about the other things, that I have dark hair, that I'm a boy. You mind that I'm gay, which is why I need you to say it. Just say it, Miranda chimes in.
Just say it, we implore. Miranda's words make their mother angrier.
Do you see what you're doing to your sister?
She picks up the paper and pushes back her chair.
Please.
When Neil's mother caught him and Peter holding hands, he was relieved. Relieved that it was undeniable proof. Relieved that he hadn't had to say a word. But then she didn't say a word. If Peter hadn't been in the room, he would have thought he'd made the whole thing up.
You're gay,
his father says now. And Peter is my boyfriend, he says.
And Peter is your boyfriend.
Miranda reaches out and holds her father's hand. They all look to Mrs. Kim. We all look to Mrs. Kim. Why does this mean so much to you? She asks. Because you're my mother. So many of us had to make our own families. So many of us had to pretend when we were home. So many of us had to leave. But every single one of us wishes we hadn't had to. Every single one of us wishes our family had acted like our family, that even when we found a new family, we hadn't had to leave the other one behind. Every single one of us would have loved to have been loved unconditionally by our parents. Don't make him leave you, we want to tell Mrs. Kim. He doesn't want to leave you. She genuinely doesn't understand what it means to hear the words out loud. She genuinely doesn't fathom why it's such a big deal for Neil to hear his parents say that he's gay, to say it like a fact, to grant it the articulation of her voice. Mrs. Kim stands there, newspaper in her hand. She stands there and looks at her son. Both mother and son are coiled and lost in their own defensiveness. There is something plaintive in Neil's argument, a vulnerability that can easily be overlooked in the heat of battle. He wants a truce, desperately wants a truce, but this time he wants a truce on his terms, not theirs. Mrs. Kim recognizes this. Even if the memory doesn't actually play for her, she feels the echoes of the moment she told her mother she was going to start a new life, thousands of miles away. That her mind was made up, and there was nothing her mother could do to stop her. How much had she wanted her mother to say, "I understand"? How much had she wanted her mother to be on her side? In fairy tales, the mother often needs to be dead. In mythology, the father must die for a prince to become a king. But who wants a family life like fairy tales, like mythology? You're gay. Mrs. Kim can hear the words in her head. She can hear them clearly. Once she's said them to herself, it should be easy to say them out loud. But still she hesitates, for the same reason that Neil needs so much to hear it. Saying the truth out loud makes it more real. Peter is your boyfriend. Somehow this seems a safer place to start. So she looks at her son and says it. Peter is your boyfriend. That would be enough for Neil. Just to hear these words from his mother, because the implications are clear, even if not said. But it's not enough for Miranda. "And," she says. The strangest thing happens then. Mrs. Kim smiles. Her daughter's irritation has made her smile, and has given her the springboard she needs to take the dive. "And," she says, "Neil is gay." She looks at all three of them in turn. "Now if that's settled, I'm going to go finish my paper in the den." There will be no embraces here. No tears besides Neil's. No further conversation. Unless you count Mr. Kim telling his son again to have some breakfast. Unless you count Miranda's smile as he sits down, the distinct pride she feels in both him and herself. Unless you count the way the words sink into Neil, the way his life feels a little more solid than it did 5 minutes before, the way he no longer feels the overpowering urge to run away. "How could this happen?" some of our parents asked us near the end. We knew what they were really asking, and some of us found the grace to say, "It was nothing you did." We return to the kiss. The crowd has started to count down the minutes until Craig and Harry hit the 24-hour mark. Not everyone is counting. There are jeers now. People from town and people from other towns who have come to protest, who've come to yell, who've come to break whatever spell that two boys kissing can cast. Some of them make a production of praying for Craig's and Harry's souls. Some hold hastily scrawled posters. "Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Homosexuality is a sin. You can't kiss your way out of hell." Some have brought their children. The police don't know what to do. Separate everyone into two camps or let them mingle. It takes only one shoving match for the separation to start. But the protesters will not be hidden. They want to be within hearing range of the cameras, of the boys. The ring around the boys holds on.
When someone needs to leave, whether to go home or just go to the bathroom, another person takes his or her place. They keep their backs to the protesters, their eyes on Craig and Harry. Tariq has now been awake for almost 30 hours. His body is racked with caffeine, his eyes blurred by so much screen time. People keep telling him to go home, take a nap, but he doesn't want to miss a moment. If Craig and Harry are going to stay awake, he'll stay awake too. Solidarity. He keeps thinking of Walt Whitman, of two boys together clinging. He wonders what Whitman would make of all this. He's kept Whitman's bust on the table next to him, watching over the scene. Craig and Harry can hear the jeering, the rumble of antipathy, but they can't hear it very clearly. Tariq offered to get them headphones to block it all out, but they're sticking to the speakers, sticking to the playlist. It helps to have words to reach for, an element of unpredictability. The day is getting warmer. Harry signals for the removal of his hoodie, but even after it's off, he's still hot, sweating. Craig can feel it too, the blush rising from Harry's skin, the dampness of his shirt. What he doesn't feel is how much Harry's legs are killing him. No matter how he shifts and kicks, he can't get them to feel normal. The ache is becoming unbearable, like someone is twisting each and every vein around each and every muscle. He tries to think of other things, but pain is the loudest broadcast. He's brought back by the 20, 19, 18 of a countdown. He feels Craig smile under his lips. 17, 16, 15. People are pressing in to see. It's getting hotter and hotter. 14, 13, 12. He tries to focus. 11, 10, 9. Tariq calls out that there are over 300,000 people watching online. 8, 7, 6. One of the news stations burns them with their lights, wants to capture this moment. 5, 4, 3. Craig is kissing him now, really kissing him, like when they were together. 2. It is so hot. The lights are so bright. 1. An enormous wave of cheering. They have made it to 24 hours. They have made it for a day. Amid the wild press of celebration, Harry starts to pass out. At exactly the same moment, Avery pulls into Ryan's driveway. Ryan is already outside waiting for him, smiling as he arrives. Avery parks the car, turns off the motor. But before he can get out of the car, Ryan jumps in. "Let's go," Ryan says. "Could I go inside for a sec?" Avery asks. "I have to pee." "We'll find someplace else," Ryan tells him. "I promise, it won't be long." Avery doesn't want to explain that it's much easier for him to use a private bathroom than a public one, especially in a town like Kindling. So he drives, all the time wondering why Ryan doesn't want him inside his house. "I have a plan," Ryan says. "Are you up for a plan?" Avery nods. "Okay, but first, a bathroom." He tells Avery to turn left, then right. They get to a strip mall road, and Ryan indicates a McDonald's coming up. "That work?" Avery pulls in. "You hungry?" "Not yet, not unless you're hungry. I just figured you could pee here." Again, Avery doesn't want to explain, so he gets out of the car, heads inside. He feels eyes on him as he goes over to the men's room. People behind the counter glaring because he hasn't bought anything. People at tables staring because they know where he's going, know what he's doing. Nobody has to be watching for Avery to feel watched. He is almost used to it, but will never truly get used to it. The feeling that he's trespassing, the feeling that he will be confronted, the feeling that the world is full of people who think different is synonymous with wrong. No matter how strong Avery gets, there will always be this subterranean fear, this nagging shame. We want to whisper to him that the only way to free yourself from shame is to realize how completely arbitrary it is. Just what he was saying a day ago. Stupid, arbitrary shit. He needs to take those words to heart. There is power in saying, I am not wrong. Society is wrong. Because there is no reason that men and women should have separate bathrooms. There is no reason that we should ever be ashamed of our bodies or ashamed of our love. We are told to cover ourselves up, hide ourselves away, so that other people can have control over us, can make us follow their rules. It is a bastardization of the concept of morality, this rule of shame. Avery should be able to walk into any restroom, any restaurant, without any fear, without any hesitation. He is relieved that it's a one-stall bathroom, that he can lock the door and have privacy. He's embarrassed by his relief, uncomfortable with the fact that he's so uncomfortable. Ryan remains oblivious in the car. Avery envies that, and is also annoyed by it. On the way out, the eyes are still there, the extra self-consciousness. Avery won't let it change his actions, not anymore. But he can't deny it's there. It's always there. We didn't lose our fear until we didn't have anything left. But we still feel fear for other people. When Avery gets back to the car, Ryan is texting with some of his friends. Everyone wants to meet you, Ryan says. This fills Avery with another kind of anxiety. Everyone? He asks. I may have told one or two or seven of my friends about you. I mean, they saw us dancing the other night. I had to keep them updated. Avery starts the car and asks, Where to? Do you want to meet some of my friends? The answer is yes, and the answer is no. The answer is that Avery wants to see more of Ryan's life, for sure. And the answer is that he likes it just being the two of them for now. Maybe later? Oh, definitely later. I just need to know whether to put them on standby or not. But we've got hours of us time to spend before that. Avery likes the sound of this. But he still feels uneasy. Not because Ryan's making him feel wrong. Maybe he's just uneasy because nothing is easy. Unease is the natural state. Cooper is driving his car around to recharge his phone's battery. He wants to go back on the hunt, see if maybe he can find someone better than the guy from last night. One last chance. One last time. He goes back to the Starbucks and sits in a corner so no one can see the screen. It's just past noon on a Sunday, but the sex sites are full of people, full of come-ons. He's got 10 messages from last night, people he ignored while he was chatting with antimatter. It's all so boring. He feels like he's spent his life looking at these faces, even though he's only had this app for a couple of months. Twink Hunter's the one who pushes him over the edge. He's blocked this guy at least 10 times. But the guy just creates a new profile and starts sending messages again. You're so cute, you're so hot, I think we'd have a great time. The guy looks like he works in a bank. He's got a shirtless photo, even though he's too old to have a shirtless photo. Before, Cooper's just hit the block key. This time, though, he types back, You're disgusting. Twink Hunter responds, You into that? And Cooper doesn't care anymore. Why the fuck does he have to be polite to people like this? You are nothing more than a desperate, pathetic pedophile. Within 10 seconds, Twink Hunter's blocked him. Cooper likes the way that feels, so he goes on. He tells the guys who want masculine only that they're just as bad as homophobes, trying to make masculine into some macho gym ideal. He tells the guys who say whites only that they're racist scum. He tells the 60-year-olds who are looking for under-18s that they are pedophiles. He tells the younger guys with naked pics that they should stop prostituting themselves. You're pathetic, he writes. You're desperate. Are you afraid to show your face? Is that why you show your dick? Does your boyfriend know you do this? I think there's something wrong with my screen. I can't tell if that's your ass or your face. You're looking for a good time? Do you really think you'll find it here? They all start blocking him. Just like that, they disappear from his phone, disappear from his life. Antimatter isn't on right now, but Cooper feels that if he were, he'd easily find a way to get blocked there, too. There's one guy, 34, who says he's long-term relationship-oriented. Cooper writes back, "How long-term do you think these relationships are? 2 hours? 3? If you want to find a husband, maybe you should stop looking for someone to fuck." Cooper figures he'll get blocked in record time, but the guy, whose screen name is TZ, writes back, "Why are you so angry?" Cooper responds, "I'm not angry, I'm just truthful." TZ doesn't buy it. "Who hurt you?" he asks. "Do you need help?" Cooper blocks him right away. No way to undo it. Gone. He takes down another daddy looking for a son, another son looking for a daddy, telling them this is no way to find family. He finds the guy from a week ago who suggested they meet in a park. He tells him to be there in 15 minutes. Then, when the guy says he's on his way, he blocks him. Let him wonder. Cooper's enjoying himself, because every time he's blocked, a new face appears. It's like an endless source of desperate discontent. Yes, there are some guys who look perfectly happy and have a sense of humor about the whole thing, but Cooper ignores them. 5 miles away, 15 miles away, 30. He could go on for hours, but the app is on to him. There must be complaints, because suddenly a message pops up telling him his account has been suspended. He's been frozen. Shut out for bad behavior. On a sex site. Fine, he thinks. He deletes the account, deletes the app. It's too easy. He heads over to another app and starts doing the same thing. They suspend him in a matter of minutes. He deletes his profile. He heads to Facebook. Instead of his, quote, friends, unquote, he decides to go after pop stars and politicians. He posts links to gay porn on Justin Bieber's page. He posts links to Nazi groups on the page for a Republican congressman who compared rape to bad weather. For Taylor Swift's page, he finds a video of a sheep being decapitated. It only takes 2.5 minutes before his profile is killed. That part of his life is over. He gets kicked out of every site he's ever created a profile on. A block on each and every one. Stacked up, these blocks make a wall. Him on one side, the rest of the world on the other. It might be his most successful barrier yet. It only takes an hour in a Starbucks for him to abandon his virtual life. Which is, if he's honest, most of his real life, too. One by one, he deletes his contacts until his phone is blank. What's left, he asks himself. The answer is a satisfying nothing. Craig thought at least his mother would come for the 24-hour mark. But the fact that she's not here means that maybe she's not watching. Maybe she doesn't know it's been a full day. Or maybe she does and has decided to stay away. With only a couple minutes left, Craig turns his thoughts back to Harry. Sweaty, sticky Harry. From the way he shifts and tenses, Craig knows he's hurting. But he's not going to back down, and Craig loves him for it. Genuinely loves him. At this point, he's not even sure where Harry's body ends and his own body begins. At this point, even their souls have become a Venn diagram, and the overlapping space grows and grows. Forget the togetherness of dating, the togetherness of sex. This is something higher. A piece of them has stopped being together and has started to be the same. The countdown begins. Craig wants Harry to know what he's feeling. Craig wants to kiss him and mean it. They may be weary, they may be broken up, but he wants them to always have this. No matter what happens after, he wants them to be at one for this. He kisses Harry as the numbers trickle down, as the second day begins. He feels so close to Harry, and then all of a sudden he can feel Harry slipping away. As the crowd goes crazy, Harry goes slack. Craig grabs him tighter, feels the edges of their lips separating, but keeps the middle there, keeps their lips together even as Harry isn't responding. He squeezes harder, and Harry reacts. As a matter of instinct, Harry begins to turn his head, but Craig stays on top of him. Harry's eyelids flutter open, and Craig, propping him up, makes the sign for water. Harry is burning up now. The crowd doesn't understand. The crowd is still cheering. But Tariq knows. Smitta knows. Harry's parents know. Craig can see it in their eyes, in their rush to get Harry water. Harry is back on his feet now, wincing. He drinks some water through a straw as Craig's lips seal their mouths shut. But Harry's still too hot. He needs air. He starts pulling up his shirt, exposing his skin. But it's a T-shirt. Stupidly, he wore a T-shirt, so there's no way to get it off. Mr. and Mrs. Ramirez are at his side, asking questions. Is he all right? He signals yes, because he knows what will happen if he signals no. Is he hot? Yes. Does he need his shirt off? Yes. Will he be okay without a shirt? Yes. Mrs. Ramirez heads off for a second. The crowd has now realized that something's going on. The cheering has stopped, and the jeering can be heard behind it. Someone's offering to get a fan, but Harry can't wait. His mother comes back with the scissors and asks him if he's sure. Yes. She hands over the scissors, and he awkwardly starts cutting the back of his shirt, right down the middle. And when it's been bisected, the two boys choreograph its delicate removal. For the first time in 24 hours, Craig's hands must sit lifeless at his side. Their lips are their only point of contact. It makes Craig feel distant, fragile. As soon as the shirt is off, Harry feels better. The fan, when it comes, brings more relief. Craig returns his hands to Harry's shoulders, his back, the heat of his skin, the slick of his sweat. Harry moves his arm around Craig, too. He moves his hand under the back of Craig's shirt. Skin on skin. Dizzying. For a moment there, Tariq thought it was over. Staring at the screen, he didn't dare to breathe. As if holding his breath could prevent Harry's lips from slipping from Craig's. But we feel this connection all the time, don't we? Our bodies don't have to be touching to be connected to one another. Our heart races without contact. Our breath holds until the threat is gone. What is it? Neil walks into Peter's bedroom and sees a deep look of concern on his face. Peter gestures to the screen. It looked for a second like Harry was going to pass out. Now they're cutting off his shirt. Who's Harry? From the kiss. Peter now points to one of the boys on the screen. Harry. Haven't you been watching? I've been doing other things. Well, it's getting pretty intense. Neil knows that this is the moment to tell Peter what happened with his family, how things feel a little different now. But Peter's too focused on the boys on the screen, isn't asking him how his morning was. And Neil is still piecing his reaction together. He doesn't want Peter's take on the situation until he has his own. Or at least that's what he tells himself, to justify staying silent. The truth is, Peter will understand, but only up to a point. Peter has never had to have such a conversation with his parents. Peter has never felt like an outsider in his own house. He might claim there were moments he has, but he hasn't really, not from Neil's point of view.
It looks like he's rallying, Peter says. It's been 24 hours, only 8 more to go. Neil gets closer. He's looking at the kiss, yes. But his eye naturally goes to Harry's torso. In 1992, when over 200,000 of us were infected and over 10,000 had died, Calvin Klein launched a new ad campaign with a white rapper named Marky Mark. If you are young and you are male, most conceptions you have of your bodily ideal can be traced to those advertisements. Every Hollister model that calls out to you, every voice in your head that tells you that abs need definition, every ounce of the Abercrombie myth can be traced directly to Marky Mark. Whether you subscribe to these ideals or reject them, they are the unrealistic standard you must face. It's what's being sold to you. Harry's torso is not like this. It dares to be a regular body as it is broadcast out among all the ideals. He is neither fat nor thin. There is a line of hair from his chest to his jeans. His stomach is not taut. You cannot see his abs. In other words, he reminds us of the way we were as teenagers, the way we were before the world set in. Why is Marky Mark smiling in those ads? It's not just that he has a perfect body. No, it's as if he knows that soon enough, our bodies will be broadcast. Soon enough, our images will enter the ether. Everyone will want to look like him, because they will feel like they are being looked at all the time. Harry, of course, knows he is being looked at. But what he looks like is the farthest thing from his mind. When your body starts to turn against you, when the surface value of the skin is nothing compared to the fireworks of pain in your muscles and your bones, the supposed truth of beauty falls away because there are more important concerns to attend to. Believe us, we know this. Avery wonders why Ryan is looking at him out of the corner of his eye, why Ryan would rather watch him than watch the road. Even when friends look at Avery, a small part of him still worries they are looking for flaws, irregularities. In this, Avery isn't all that different from anyone else. We all worry that looking at is really looking for. Finally, Avery can't stand it. The look, then a knowing smile, then another look. "What?" he asks. This only makes Ryan smile more. "I'm sorry," he says. "I don't usually like people. So when I do, part of me is really amused, and the other part refuses to believe it's happening." Maybe this is why we like watching you so much. Everything is still new to you. We are long past the experience, although we witness new things all the time. But you? New is not just a fact. New can be an emotion. "What are we doing?" Avery asks. It is not meant as an existential question. He just wants to know what they're doing next. "I figured we'd start with pancakes. Do you want pancakes?" It's hard to imagine a scenario where someone would say no to pancakes. So they go to a pancake house. Because it's a small town, Avery notices Ryan checking out who else is inside before committing to a table. "Looking for anyone in particular?" Ryan smiles again. "No, just habit, I guess." "How many people are in your high school?" "About 200. You?"
"80.
"You must stick out. I mean, with the pink hair and all."
"I bet you blend right in."
"Trying to blend in would be like being put through a blender. I abstain." Avery finds this funny.
"What did you just say?"
"I said,
I abstain.
Is that what you say when the popular kids try to get you to hang out with them? I'm sorry, but I abstain from blending in. There are just too many perks to being a wallflower.
Yep, that's precisely what I say. But do they stop? No. The popular kids keep bugging me. Calling, texting, showing up on my doorstep, begging like dogs. I'm embarrassed for them.
I know precisely how you feel. To emphasize his point, Avery squeezes Ryan's hand. It's such an openly lame excuse to touch him, and both of them smile in acknowledgement of this. Part of you is amused, Avery says, and part of you doesn't believe this is happening. Ryan nods.
And in the Pancake Century Diner, of all places.
Well, Avery says, it is the Pancake Century, after all. The waitress comes to take their order. Each of them thinks about pulling his hand away, but neither of them does. Craig thinks of pancakes. He thinks of warm maple syrup and blueberries and butter melting. He thinks of the savory smoke of bacon on his tongue, a glass of cold orange juice. He tries to conjure their taste, but taste is elusive when it comes to memory. So instead he has to rely on his memory of how they look, how they smell, how happy they make him. He focuses back on Harry. Harry, who is fading. Craig feels awful for thinking it, but the thought is there. If they don't make it now, it will probably be because of Harry. Craig's texted over his shoulder, asked him if he's okay, and Harry keeps saying he is, keeps saying now that he's cooled down, he's back on track. But Craig can feel the lie throughout Harry's body, can touch the tight muscles, can notice all the small movements Harry is making to keep himself upright, to keep himself going. And I was never the stronger one, Craig allows himself to say it, if only to himself. All through their relationship, Harry was the one in charge. Harry was the one who gave them direction. This wasn't because Harry was smarter or even better at it than Craig was. It just meant more to him to be in control. And Craig didn't really care, so he ceded it away. He liked not being responsible all the time. Complacency. Craig realizes now that this was complacency. One of the reasons he liked the sound of Harry's voice was because it meant he didn't have to use his own. But eventually this strategy backfired. Eventually Harry realized what was happening and didn't feel right about it. He wanted Craig to fight a little more, but by the time Craig started fighting for them to stay together, he had already lost. Now he's fighting for something different, something that feels more elemental. He's fighting to stay standing. He's fighting to go without food, without a bathroom. He's fighting to keep his lips on Harry's for 7 more hours. And he's fighting to help Harry do all of these things as well. It's one of the secrets of strength. We're so much more likely to find it in the service of others than we are to find it in service to ourselves. We have no idea why this is. It's not just the mother who lifts the car to free her child, or the guy who shields his girlfriend when the gunman starts to fire. Those are extremes, brave extremes, which life rarely calls on us to offer. No, it is the less extreme strength, a strength that is not so much situational as it is constitutional, that we will find in order to give. How often did we see this as we were dying? How many soft-spoken lovers turned into fierce watchdogs over our care? How many reticent parents shed that reticence to be there with us? Not all. Certainly not everyone showed strength. Some supposedly strong people in our lives showed that their strength was actually made of straw.
but so many held us up in ways they would not have held themselves. They saw us through, even as their worlds crumbled through their fingers. They kept fighting, even after we were gone, or especially because we were gone. They kept fighting for us. We are gone, and maybe our spirits are gone too, as the ones who knew us stop remembering us so often, or come to join us. But the spirit of that strength, it carries through. It is there for the taking. You just have to reach for it and find it, as Craig is doing now. He would never grasp at it for himself, not in this way. But for Harry, he will. Cooper, meanwhile, refuses to grasp. He refuses to hold. He refuses to feel. We watch him letting go, but we will not let go of him. He is driving without realizing he is driving. He knows there is a destination out there for him, and he is working his way toward it. In the meantime, he is taking the empty census of people who love him. He is not afraid of hurting anyone, because he doesn't think anyone cares about him enough to be hurt. Surely they will go through the motions. They will have their tears once he's left. But underneath that performance of sadness, he feels their relief. They don't want him to come back, so he won't. Love, he thinks, is a lie that people tell each other in order to make the world bearable. He is not up for the lie anymore. And nobody is going to lie to him like that anyway. He's not even worth a lie. We want him to take a census of the future. We want him to consider that love does make the world bearable, but that does not make it a lie. We want him to see the time when he will feel it, truly feel it, for the first time. But the future is something he is no longer considering. In his mind, the future is a theory that has already been proven false. What a powerful word, future. Of all the abstractions we can articulate to ourselves, of all the concepts we have that other animals do not, how extraordinary the ability to consider a time that's never been experienced. And how tragic not to consider it. It galls us, we with such a limited future, to see someone brush it aside as meaningless when it has an endless capacity for meaning and an endless number of meanings that can be found within it. Sing us that old refrain. Where do you want to go? I don't know. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? The feed of the two boys kissing stays on in the background as Neil and Peter play video games in Neil's room. Peter senses something is not quite right with Neil. His heart doesn't seem into the game, and it's the game he brought over a few days ago, desperate to make it to level 32 by the end of the week. Peter is afraid it's still about the stupid text he got from Simon, or about something else that's them related. So he doesn't say anything, because he knows Neil will bring it up when he's ready to bring it up. Maybe it isn't anything at all. For his part, Neil doesn't understand why he isn't talking to Peter, why he's killing Russian assassins instead of telling Peter that his world has shifted. He's waiting for Peter to ask him what's happened, because he thinks it's clear something's happened, and why should he always have to be the one to point it out? Peter pauses the game. Are you hungry? He asks. Not really, is Neil's reply. Thirsty? No. Do you want to do something else? Do you want to do something else? Are you in the throes of constipation? Neil is not in the mood for this. No. Pregnant? No. Sick of this game? Which game? The one you're playing?
Which one am I playing? The one on the screen right now? Balkan Bloodbath 12? Oh, no, I'm fine. Here's where Peter should say it, what's going on. But instead he unpauses the game. If you're fine, he says, I'm fine. They continue to play. Ryan hasn't had to spend much time thinking about where to take Avery next, because already they are running out of cool places in Kindling. If they're not on the river, or at Aunt Caitlin's, or in the Pancake Century Diner, there are very few places worth exploring. The Kindling Cafe is the one that's left, but that's where everyone is. He wants Avery to meet his friends, but not yet. He still wants them to be alone together, with no one watching, no one even noticing. This is Ryan's relationship to this town. He doesn't really want to leave any marks, and he wants Kindling to leave as few marks as possible on him. He knows he's been defined by this town. And of course, the more he's tried to resist definition, the more they've defined him. But this time with Avery, needs to exist outside definition. Or, at the very least, he and Avery need to get a chance to define it themselves. So he directs Avery to Mr. Footer's, the old relic of a miniature golf course. It's been closed for years now, but no one's bought the land, so it sits in its abandoned state, nearly post-apocalyptic in its decay. There's a lock on the gates, but the gates themselves have worn away in places, making it easy to come and go. At night, it's a breeding ground for stoners and crankheads, but during the day, it's graveyard quiet. "Where exactly are you taking me?" Avery asks. Ryan has a flash of seeing the sight through his eyes and realizes this might be a mistake. But he doesn't want to turn back now. He tells Avery to park in front. "When I was a kid," he explains, "this place was the best place around. Like, if you were really good and did all your chores, Mom and Dad would take you here. You'd play all the mini golf you could, and then there'd be ice cream and video games in the hut over there, after." Avery takes it all in. "So what happened?" Ryan shrugs. "One day it was here, and then the next day there was a sign saying it was over. It's sat here ever since, abandoned." "And do you come here often?" "Only with special people." "Oh, gee, I'm so flattered," Avery deadpans. But in a way, he is flattered. Had Ryan driven over to Marigold, Avery would have been forced to take him to a TGI Fridays or a movie. This is definitely not that. "Let's go," Ryan says. They leave the car and crawl through a gap in the gate. Inside, everything is broken. Toppled windmills, fetid moats, bottles left smashed and cans left crushed. "Want to play?" Avery asks. Ryan looks at the torn-up greens, the holes filled with cigarette butts. "I'm not sure that will work," he says. "There aren't any clubs anymore. Or golf balls." "So?" "So it's hard to play mini-golf without those things." "Use your imagination," Avery says, walking to the base of the first green and putting down an invisible ball. "This is the most amazing mini-golf course ever created. For example, this hole is patrolled by live alligators. If they swallow your ball, it's 3 strokes. If they swallow you, it's 5. Avery takes an exaggerated swing with a non-existent club, then makes a production of watching the ball soar into the air and drop to the green. "Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on," he murmurs. Then he sighs. "Not a hole in one, but at least I dodged the gators. Your turn." Ryan walks over and puts down his own invisible ball. "I hope you don't mind that I took the pink one," he says.
"I don't mind at all."
Ryan swings at the ball. They both watch it rise and fall.
Not bad, Avery says.
At least I didn't hit a gator.
Ryan thinks Avery will stop then, will want to leave this desolate place. But he heads right over to where his ball is and makes the putt, then steps out of the way for Ryan's turn. Ryan follows his lead, but misses the shot. He gets the next one in. Avery makes a gesture of gathering the golf balls, then walks to the next hole. Your turn, he says. What's the story? The story Ryan tells is that this green is riddled with troughs of chocolate. If your ball falls in, it will taste better, but will also slow you down. And actually, the golf ball is no longer a ball. It's a golf ball-size gobstopper. The story Ryan feels is a different matter. The story Ryan feels is the one that's being written with each minute. This confounding and enjoyable story of the two of them finding a good time in what he now sees is a remarkably dire place. He's always appreciated how derelict it was, but that was when he was feeling pretty derelict himself. In the past couple of years, there was some catharsis in seeing his childhood so visibly trashed, as if there was some confirmation here about what growing up should feel like. But with Avery, a little of that old wonder returns. Ryan plays along, and it's a relief to be playing. By the fifth hole, they're not even golfing anymore. They're just describing all the things they don't really see. Avery erects the Taj Mahal on hole 5, and Ryan presents the world's first anti-gravity mini-golf on hole 6. At hole 7, they start walking hand in hand, surveyors of an imaginary landscape. Instead of solemnly holding hands, they swing them back and forth, stretch out and pull back together. The sun isn't shining, but they don't notice. If anyone were to ask them later, they'd swear that it was. It is not as simple as Ryan looking at Avery and feeling they've known each other forever. In fact, it doesn't feel like that at all. Ryan feels like he is just getting to know Avery, and that getting to know Avery isn't going to be like getting to know anyone else he's ever gotten to know. There's a wishing well in the middle of the ninth hole. This is not imaginary. It is sitting there, largely intact from its glory days. Avery reaches into his pocket and pulls out a penny. No, Ryan finds himself saying, don't. Avery shoots him a quizzical look. Don't? I've thrown pennies in that well all my life, and not a single wish has ever come true. As a kid, he wished for money or fame or toys or friends. More recent wishes were for so many other things, all of them synonymous with love or escape. He worries he's ruined it now, by suddenly being serious. That's always been his problem, his inability to live in false worlds for that long. Avery doesn't ask him what he wished for. He doesn't need to. Here, he says. Maybe you didn't do it right. Avery takes the penny and moves it to Ryan's lips. Ryan holds there, not really knowing what's happening. Then Avery leans in and kisses him so that they are both kissing the penny. When he pulls back, the penny falls, and he catches it in his palm. Now make a wish, he says. And Ryan thinks, I want to be happy. Got it? Avery asks. Ryan nods, and Avery tosses the penny into the well. They both listen, but neither hears it land. Then Avery returns to him, comes closer again, and now they are kissing with nothing between them. Lips closed, then lips open. Hands empty, then hands entwined. A minute or two of this,
Then Avery pulls back and says,